Donald Friend was one of Australia's greatest artists of the last few decades. He grew up on the family property in Glendon in northwest New South Wales, and as a boy he was exceptionally close to his mother. They would spend evenings reading and talking and treasuring their quiet time together in their family home. But as he grew up, a dark shadow came between them. It all began when his mother wanted to buy a home in Elizabeth Bay. In order to do that, she needed to get help from her children. Basically, £1,000 each child would enable her to buy this particular house that she had fallen in love with. Well, Donald's sister, Gwen, fell in love with the home straight away, and she agreed to pay the money. His other brother, Harley, also agreed to the deal, but when Donald was approached, he refused. No way were they going to get £1,000 out of him. And after that, Donald's sister, Gwen, wasn't even allowed to mention Donald's name anymore within the presence of her mother. What was once a great relationship had degenerated to such a point that they seemed to hate now rather than love one another. Several years after this, Donald's mother had dementia, and his sister Gwen was looking after her alone and realised that she needed help. So she phoned Donald, who was living at that time in Bali, and he wrote back and said to her, "Dear Gwen, as you know, I came here to put myself out of reach of Sydney and all of its inhabitants. You also know that I loathe being tracked down and pestered with phone calls, yours especially, which normally cost me £100 a go. I detest family affairs, and this is positively my swan song. If all the Friends, Lawsons and Moses were to be swallowed by the undying worm, my expressions of regret would be entirely formal." He then offered to pay a certain amount of money through his accountant each month, and he said that that should be enough to buy him right out of the whole shooting box. And for her part, his mother had written him entirely out of her will. She said in her will to Donald Friend, "I wish not one possession of mine to be given to him, nor in any way is he to have access to my personal belongings." Now there's no doubt, is there, that relationships can go wrong, even good ones. Marriages can become battlegrounds, friends can so easily become enemies. Families can become tangled webs of hatred and hurt. Churches can become divided and bitter. Relationships can so easily go wrong. But what do you do when they do go wrong? How do you make them right again? Well, when we ask those questions, probably most of us will immediately think of Matthew 18, where Jesus talks about what to do when a brother sins against you. And it's probably a fairly good place to turn. The trouble is, when we go to that passage, we usually begin in the middle of it. Now, there are times when it's okay to begin reading something in the middle. Australian men do it every day when they go and buy their newspaper. They always go to the middle, to the sports section or the business section, rather than to the headlines at the front. And it doesn't really matter all that much if you read the newspaper in that way, does it? My wife, Susan, bought a book called Couplehood a little while ago by Paul Reiser. And the guy who writes it, he's the fellow that stars in that Mad About You show that's on TV. You might have seen it. He begins his book at page 145, and he says the reason he does that is because he likes to be partway into a book with some bit of it to go, so he starts at page 145. So now and again it's okay, I guess, to start in the middle, but generally it's not a good idea. Generally, if you begin to read something in the middle, you lose the plot. And that's certainly true of Matthew chapter 18. So what I propose to do this morning is to look at the whole of Matthew chapter 18 and see what it tells us about putting relationships that have gone wrong right. And it says quite a bit. Now we'll begin in chapter 18 and verse 1. "At that time the disciples came to Jesus and asked, 'Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?'" Now straight away the writer is telling us there that the context of this whole chapter is of the disciples wondering which of them is the greatest. In other words, the context is the disciples' pride. That's the context. See, pride stands behind many of our problems in relationships, doesn't it? When we begin to think more highly of ourselves than we should, then we also begin to think that we deserve better than we're getting, that we should be able to get away with more than we're getting away with because of who we are. And as soon as we begin to think like that, then we begin to act like that as well. You begin to take advantage of other people. And as soon as you do that, the rot sets in relationships. The disciples were arguing about who was the greatest. Verse 2, he called a little child and had him stand among them. And he said, I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Now Jesus goes on and he tells them that if they want to be great, then they need to become like children. And generally, children aren't concerned about their social status, are they? You don't very often see upwardly mobile kids or kids running around with their mobile phones and all that sort of stuff. They're not class conscious. They just don't think in that way. Jesus says we need to be like little children. But then he goes on to talk about the peril of leading little ones astray, verses 5 and 6. And whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. But if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a large millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. So when we see little children led astray, it sickens us, doesn't it? In New South Wales recently, we've got this whole Royal Commission thing, the Police Royal Commission going on. And lately they've been looking at the whole area of pedophilia. And it's horrendous, isn't it, to see the sort of things that people will do to little children, the way in which they will use them for their own gratification. It is totally sickening to see that sort of thing happen. When I was in Thailand a couple of years ago, one of the places that we went to was a little village way up in the north of Thailand. And as we were wandering around this village, I noticed on one of the huts up there an AIDS poster. And I said to our guide, why is that there? Why would there be any need for an AIDS poster way up here? The response that I got was this. He said, well, lots of the people here are very poor. And so people come up from Bangkok and they offer the children a good job down in the city, take them away, give the parents money. And when the children come back, spewed up and spat out by the whole prostitution bit that they've been a part of, they're also riddled with AIDS and with all sorts of sexually transmitted disease. It is sickening for people to use little ones in that way. And Jesus is saying that when people treat little ones in that way, then God is ropeable. He is ropeable when little ones are led astray. And little ones here in this context in Matthew 18 is of course referring to his disciples. He is angry, he is ropeable when someone leads his disciples astray. But he goes on and says in verse 7, woe to the world because of the things that cause people to sin. Such things must come, but woe to the man through whom they come. If your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than to have two hands or two feet and to be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. Now these verses are a little more personal than the ones that have come before it. He was talking generally before, but here he is saying to us, if you cause someone to sin, if you lead someone else astray, then cut off the member of your body that did it. If it's your eye, pluck it out. If it's your hand, cut it off. If it's your foot, amputate it. Now if you've read Matthew recently, then you'll remember that Jesus urged his disciples to do the same thing back in the Sermon on the Mount. There he had in mind adultery. But here I think he has in mind pride, and he's saying deal radically with it. Deal radically with pride, because it will lead others to sin. It will cause you to be a stumbling block, and God views it very seriously indeed if we cause one of his disciples to sin. Now this is sobering stuff, isn't it? See, how do you respond if someone is offended by you? Often the way I respond, I know, is to just fob it off. I say, oh, that's their problem, they're too sensitive. Want to make a mountain out of a molehill. That's often our temptation, isn't it? But Jesus says if we cause offence, it's not just their problem. It's our problem too. We ought to try our very best not to give offence to people. And if we do, then we ought to take it very seriously. We ought to deal with it very seriously indeed. Well, let's press on. Having shown us that God views leading a disciple astray very seriously, Jesus moves on to show us what God's attitude is to those who are led astray in verses 10 to 14. He says there, "See that you do not look down on one of these little ones, for I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven. What do you think? If a man owns 100 sheep and one of them wanders away, will he not leave the 99 on the hills and go to look for the one that wandered off? And if he finds it, I tell you the truth, he is happier about that one sheep than about the 99 that did not wander off. In the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should be lost." My wife Susan wears contact lenses, and every now and again she loses one in the bathroom as she's putting them on or as she's taking them off. I don't know if you've ever tried looking for contact lenses. They're a real pain of a thing to look for, aren't they? I think they should, when they manufacture them, they should put a big black X right across the centre so that you at least have a fighting chance to find them. I guess that might affect your view of the world, perhaps, which wouldn't be such a good thing, but it certainly would help. But every now and again, when one's lost, we get the torch out and we sort of get down on our hands and knees and we scour the bathroom floor and every other part of the house as well, looking for this tiny little piece of glad wrap that costs about $100. Now, Jesus is saying in this story that that's how God searches for people who go astray. He searches high and low for them. He hunts them down because he is not willing that they should be lost. And when he finds them, he throws a great party. Now we need to ask ourselves, I think, in the light of this parable, if we share God's concern for those who go astray. So do we go to that sort of length to win them back? Because often we don't, do we? If someone leaves the church or the fellowship that we're a part of or falls out with us, it's all too easy for us to simply let them go. We console ourselves with the thought that the problem's with them, that they're rejecting the truth, they're free agents, it's up to them to do what they want to do. How they live their lives is their thing, not our place to interfere. But often all we're doing in all of that is protecting ourselves, aren't we? See, to think like that stops us from examining ourselves. Maybe we could have avoided the problem. Maybe our conduct has been wrong. Maybe they have been hurt by something we said, by help that we failed to give, by love and acceptance that we failed to show. See, to ask those questions, to face those possibilities, is to swallow your pride, to admit that maybe we haven't been the greatest, and we don't like to do that, do we? We would rather think that we were. So how many people have we allowed to leave our churches, or have we fallen out with personally, simply because we were too proud to admit that we might have been wrong, that maybe it was our problem, too proud to apologise. Friends, in relationships, we need to swallow our pride, particularly when things have gone wrong, and we need to take on the mind of God, the God who goes to extraordinary lengths to seek out and bring home the lost because he doesn't want any to perish. Well, what are we to do? Well, Jesus goes on and tells us in verses 15 to 17, and he talks here about a brother who sins against us. Verse 15, "If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. If he listens to you, then you have won your brother over. But if he will not listen, take one or two others along with you, so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church, and if he refuses to listen even to the church, treat him as you would a pagan or a tax collector." Now, what's Jesus saying to us here about dealing with problems? Well, I think he gives us two principles to work on. and the first is the KISS principle. But it's not keep it simple, stupid, it's keep it small, stupid. That's the KISS principle. See, if you've got a problem with someone, if someone has done the wrong thing by you, then Jesus says, don't tell everyone about it. Don't ask your Bible study group to pray about it. Go and see them about it yourself. And if they won't listen, then Jesus says, the circle of those who are let in on this problem becomes wider, until in some cases it needs to be dealt with at the church level. But that is always to be the last resort. You keep the problem as small and as contained as possible. Now, there's obvious good sense in that, isn't there? Because when problems are shared around from person to person, they have this strange way of taking on a life of their own, don't they? People only get part of the story, and so being what we are, they make up the rest for themselves. It ends up getting better and better all the time, bigger and bigger all the time. People pass judgments on other people on the basis of half-truths or lies. And in the end, if the truth does come out, as inevitably it does, the damage has been done. Ironic, isn't it? In those cases, people often don't believe the truth when it finally does come out. They like the lies that they've grown up with themselves. The principle of containment is a very important principle in dealing with problems. Keep it small, Jesus says. But the second principle that we need to observe from here, though, is the principle of importance. See, if you're going to follow this procedure that Jesus sets down here in dealing with a problem, then he says it needs to be an important matter. Before you even start to go down this track, you need to ask yourself, am I prepared to follow this through to the point that I would eventually take it to the church if I had to? Now, it seems to me that that's very important. Because it could be that we're the ones who are overly sensitive or who are overly offended. And Jesus is not giving us a mandate here to race off to people on our own and to deal with all sorts of problems with a couple of witnesses about trifling matters. He is telling us how to deal with situations in which people are being genuinely led astray from the faith or are likely to be. He says we must be careful not to use these verses as a mandate to get at people who have offended our pride, because we can do that all too easily. Well, Jesus goes on in verses 18 to 20, and he says there, I tell you the truth, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three come together in my name, there am I with them. Excuse me here, my nose is running like a tap this morning. Well, these verses are very well-known verses, aren't they? But let me say that they're not talking about what we usually think they're talking about. Often those verses are seen as a promise about prayer. Now, if two or three agree on earth, God will give us what we're after. They're also seen, I think, as a great promise about church. How often have you been in church when the leader has begun by saying, Father, we thank you for your promise that wherever two or three are gathered together in your name, then you are there with them. We often use those verses in that way, don't we? But they're not about that. They're not about prayer, and they're not about church. They are about sorting out problems. That's the context, isn't it? And the context is that which determines the meaning of the Bible. See, the two or three that he's talking about here is the two or three that are meeting together to sort the problem out that he's just spoken about. They are the offended party and the offender, and if necessary, the witness that has been taken along. And Jesus is saying that if those people can agree on earth, if they can come to a satisfactory resolution of their problem, then that agreement will be ratified in heaven, because wherever brothers and sisters come together on the basis of harmony, Jesus will be there with them. I was reading the other day in some magazine, I can't remember what it was now, but they had a paraphrase of this particular verse. And the paraphrase went like this. If two or three of you can agree on anything, then I'll come to see it for myself. Uh, And that's about the size of it, isn't it? I mean, I think that paraphrase, as funny as it is, actually captures the meaning of what Jesus is saying here in these verses. See, as we've seen, God hates his children causing offence to one another. He always goes to great lengths to seek out and to find the sheep that has gone astray. And he expects us to do that as well. And when we do, when we go to that trouble to maintain unity, then God is pleased to live with us and to make his home with us. Now that's not easy to do though, is it? We're proud and we find it hard to swallow our pride. And if we're going to maintain unity and get wrong relationships right, then one thing that we need to do above all else is to learn to forgive. Now Peter, along with all of the other disciples, has been listening to Jesus' words, and at this point he pipes up, as he often does in verse 21, and he says, "Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother when he sins against me? Up to seven times." Now Peter recognised in what Jesus was saying the need for forgiveness, and he thought that in suggesting seven times, I think that he was being particularly generous. The rabbis of the day thought that you had to forgive a person up to three times. But on the fourth occasion, you could tell them to go and get lost. You didn't have to forgive them then. And so Peter thought that his suggestion of seven times was more than ample. But he wasn't quite ready for Jesus' response. Now have a look at verse 22. Jesus answered, "I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times." Now, of course, Jesus is not providing a legalistic number here like the Pharisees were. He's not saying to you, you have to forgive 77 times, but on the 78th time you can say, "Get out of here. There's no way. Your number's up, buddy. I'm not going to forget you." He's not saying that. He is saying you must forgive and you must keep on forgiving. And to make his point, he goes on to tell a parable. Verse 23. "Therefore the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt." Now, the amount that this money owes is an enormous sum. Some have estimated that it is probably worth about $12 million in today's currency, although Don Carson, who wrote that marvellous volume that you were encouraged to buy before, Don Carson said that it probably with inflation and fluctuating values of precious metals, it could be worth as much as $1 billion today. It's an enormous sum that this man is owing, and there's no way that he's able to pay it back. It's impossible. And so he falls down in verse 26 at his master's feet and he asks for patience. He says, "Be patient with me and I will pay back everything." And you know the thing that strikes me about that statement as I read it? It's how unreasonable it is. Because there is no way in the world that this man will ever be able to pay back the amount that he owed. It was totally impossible. But look at how the master responds to him. Amazingly, graciously, the master simply cancels the debt. $12 million written off his account right then and there, just for the asking. I mean, what a deal. It's better than winning lotto, isn't it? And you reckon he'd be happy because of what he's been forgiven. But look at what he does. He goes out and he finds another man who owed him 100 denarii. An amount which was paltry compared to the amount which he had just been forgiven. And he begins to choke this other man. "Pay back what you owe me," he says. Now let's just stop and get this in perspective for a moment. A denarius was a day's wage. So we're looking here at maybe $5,000 that this man is owing the other fellow who's been forgiven. $5,000 compared to $12 million. The two sums can't be compared. But despite this, the forgiven man grabs the other by the throat and he starts to choke him. And look at how he responds in verse 29. The fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, "Be patient with me and I will pay you back." See, he asks the same question. It's exactly the same question as the other fellow had asked of his debtor just a little while ago. It's the same question, but he gets a terribly different response. A very different response. Now, the other thing that's interesting about this is that in this case, the question, the comment, is quite reasonable, isn't it? I mean, before, to pay back 12 million, the man had no chance of doing it. But this fellow who only owes 5,000 denarius, there's every chance that he'll be able to pay this man back. Set himself to work, get the jobs done, and he'll be able to pay him back probably within a year. It's a very reasonable request that he puts, but the response that he gets doesn't go along with that. Rather than being forgiven, the servant has him thrown into prison until he repays the debt. And when word got back to the other master, he was not happy. He has the servant brought before him and he treats him as he had treated his debtor. He throws him into prison to be tortured until he can repay the debt. Well, what is Jesus' point here? It's very simple, isn't it? And it's also very obvious. Jesus' teachings are so clear. He's saying to us, we have been forgiven an enormous amount by God, and at great cost, at the cost of the life of his Son. We've been forgiven, and God expects us, indeed he requires us, to offer to one another the same forgiveness that he has so generously given to us. Not seven times, not even 77 times, but again and again and again. And what a great thing it is to be forgiven. It's tremendous, isn't it, to be forgiven. We take it for granted so often. When Donald's friend lay dying of cancer, his sister Gwen nursed him. She was a good sister to him after all that he had done. And she recalls how one day Donald finally asked about his mother. The question he asked was this: did she ever forgive and forget? I feel a sense of guilt about her now. Did she say anything? And his sister looked at him and she said she saw not only guilt there, but a depthless sadness. She decided she had no choice but to lie. She said she sent you her love. That's sad, isn't it? She couldn't tell him the truth, because the truth was his mother died wishing not one possession of hers be given to him or for him to have any access to her belongings. She didn't forgive him, she didn't forget, and she didn't love him. She hated him. But friends, the truth about you and I is that if we trust in Christ, God has forgiven our sin. He has forgotten it. And he loves us. And he expects us to forgive and forget one another's sin and to love one another. Our dealings with one another are not to be ruled by pride, but by love. And when a brother or sister goes astray, we are to do everything in our power to win them back, because we serve a God who is a shepherd to his children and who is not willing that any of them should perish, but that they remain a part of his flock, a part of his family.